Chapter 8. Frank's Story. Before the coroner's jury reconvened Monday afternoon, the new Fulton County grand jury was sworn in by Judge W.D. Ellis Monday morning. In his charge to the members, the judge impressed on them the necessity for considering the Fagan case before all else if they should be called upon to take up a charge against a man accused of murdering the little girl. In referring to the case, the judge said, "The Mary Fagan case calls for your immediate and vigorous attention. The power of the state is behind you. What appears to be an awful crime has been committed, and the welfare of the community, the good name of Atlanta, public justice, and the majesty of the law demand at the hands of this grand jury and of all officers of the law the most searching investigation and the prompt bringing to trial of the guilty party." At 2:30 Monday afternoon, the coroner's jury took up anew its probe of the murder of Mary Fagan. Leo M. Frank was the first witness called. For 3 hours and a half, he stayed on the stand, telling a complete story of where he was and what he did on the day of the murder, alternately interrupted by questions on the part of the coroner, Solicitor Dorsey, and Chief Lanford. The only other witnesses examined during the afternoon were Mr. and Mrs. Emile Selig, at whose home the Franks lived, Selig being Frank's father-in-law. Frank at first testified that he had formerly lived in Brooklyn, New York, that he left Brooklyn in October 1907, that he went abroad, and returning to the United States, went to work for the National Pencil Company, where he came to be general superintendent. He said in that capacity his duties were to look after the purchase of material, inspect factory costs, see that orders were properly entered and filled, and look after the production in general. Frank told how he came down to the factory as usual Saturday morning, and of the customary routine there until the hour of noon. His work lightened somewhat, owing to the fact that the day was a holiday, and there were only 11 people in the factory. He told how shortly after 12, Miss Hall, the stenographer, and Alonzo Mann, the office boy, left the building, when he started copying orders in the shipping requests. He said that at that time, so far as he knew, there was no one left in the office. "About 12:10 or 12:05, said Frank, "this little girl who was killed came up and got her envelope. I didn't see or hear anyone with her. I didn't hear her speak to anyone who might have been outside. I was in my office working at the orders when she came up. I don't remember exactly what she said. I looked up, and when she told me she wanted her envelope, I handed it to her. Knowing that the employees would be coming in for their pay envelopes, I had them all in the cash basket beside me to save walking to the safe each time." Frank said he didn't know Mary Fagan's number. He said each envelope had the employee's number stamped on it. He admitted that he had looked up Mary Fagan's number since the murder, but he had forgotten it again, he said. He did not see her pay envelope after he handed it to her. He made no entry of the payment on the payroll or any other record, because none was required, said he. The girl left. She got to the outer door and asked if the medal had come. I told her no. He explained that the Fagan child hadn't been working since Monday because of the shortage in the medal supply. There was $1.20 in the child's pay envelope, he said, part of it being for work on Friday and Saturday of the previous week. He didn't know at what rate she was paid, he said, as he didn't open the sealed pay envelope. When she left, he heard her footsteps die away in the hall, he said, and returned to his work, thinking no more about it. Frank said he knew the Fagan child's face, but didn't know her name. She stood partly behind his desk, he said, and he didn't notice the details of her dress, but thought the color was light. He didn't recall whether she wore a hat, or carried a parasol or purse, he said, and didn't see her shoes or stockings, which, he said, were hidden by the desk. The girl reached his office between 12:10 and 12:15, he said, and stayed there about 2 minutes. He thought her name was on the outside of the pay envelope, he said, but had identified her by her number. No one else came into the office while she was there, the witness said. In response to a question from the coroner, he said that he had told her she had come almost too late. When she left, he thought he heard her voice in the outer office, he said. He made no entry on the payroll after giving the girl her envelope, he said. Frank then made a startling statement. It was that 5 or 10 minutes after Mary Fagan left, Lemmy Quinn, foreman in the tip department, entered his office. Quinn stayed a few minutes, said Frank. They had some small talk, and the foreman left about 12:25 p.m. He said that Quinn knew Mary Fagan, being head of the department in which the girl worked. Before Frank left the office, he went up to the fourth floor, according to his story, where he found Harry Denham and Arthur White and Mrs. White, the two boys being employees of the factory. Frank said he then went home, reaching there about 1:20 Saturday afternoon. About 3 o'clock, he said, he came back to the factory. Shortly after, he said, White and Denham, whom he found working on the third floor on his return, left the building, White borrowing $2 from him on his way downstairs. He went downstairs after them, he said, and locked the door. The rest of the afternoon, he said, he spent in work on the financial sheet. He described Lee's arrival early in the afternoon, how he told him to come back, and how about 6 o'clock, after the Negro had returned, Gant came and got his shoes. He then went home, he said, reaching there about 6:25. He told how he phoned Lee at the factory. Frank said he went to bed at 11 o'clock. He continued his story with what happened the following Sunday. Frank described his conversation with Lee at the police station on the Monday following the murder, when detectives told him to interview the black and try to get a confession out of him. Frank said he told the watchman, "They know you know something. They can swing us both if you don't tell." Just what the detectives had asked him to say. A little after 6 o'clock, Frank descended from the stand, as unruffled by the terrific grilling and bombardment of questions he had received as he had been before he testified. He stated to a reporter that he was not tired at all, and indeed he did not appear to be, despite the trying experience. Emil Selig and his wife, Mrs. Josephine Selig, followed Frank on the witness stand. In effect, they testified the same, that they saw Frank at dinner Saturday, at supper Saturday, that he went to bed about 11 o'clock, and that he had left for the factory when they awoke Sunday morning. They did not infer that he appeared nervous at any time. At 7:20 p.m., the inquest adjourned until 9:30 Thursday morning. The intervening days were allowed in order that more witnesses might be subpoenaed, and that the statements made by Frank thoroughly investigated. Lemmy Quinn, who had first told detectives that he had not been at the pencil factory at all Saturday, admitted that he was wrong. He said that he had forgotten his visit, that he had stayed but a short while, and was only in Frank's office for a minute. He indignantly denied that he had been offered a bribe to protect Frank by his testimony. Thursday morning, when the inquest resumed, 6 witnesses testified. They were Boots Rogers, Lemmy Quinn, Miss Corinthia Hall, a factory employee, Miss Hattie Hall, stenographer at the factory, J. L. Watkins, and Miss Daisy Jones. Though put through a searching examination by the coroner in an effort to break down his statement that he had visited the factory on the day of the tragedy, shortly after noon, just after Mary Fagan is supposed to have received her pay envelope and left, Quinn stuck to his story. Boots Rogers testified that Mr. Frank had changed the tape in the time clock while the officers were in the factory Sunday morning, after the body of Mary Fagan had been found, and that he stated at the time that the sheet he took from the clock seemed to be correct. Rogers also described Mr. Frank's manner when the officers went to his home in an automobile to take him to the factory Sunday morning. Miss Corinthia Hall, an employee in the factory, testified that Mr. Frank's treatment of the girls in the factory was unimpeachable. She also testified that she had met Lemmy Quinn at a restaurant near the factory near the noon hour Saturday, her statement being confirmatory of his visit to the factory on the fatal day. J.L. Watkins testified that he had mistaken Miss Daisy Jones for Mary Fagan when he thought he saw Mary on the street near her home on Saturday afternoon about 5 o'clock. Miss Jones's testimony was also in this connection. At the afternoon session Thursday, Detective Harry Scott of the Pinkerton Agency was one of the first witnesses called. He followed Assistant Superintendent Schiff of the pencil factory, who was excused after short testimony. The most startling statement made by Scott was that Herbert Haas, one of Frank's attorneys, had requested him to withhold all evidence from the police until Haas himself had considered it. Scott said that he told Haas he would withdraw from the case first. Scott said he was still employed by the pencil factory. Detective John Black followed Scott on the stand and told of finding a bloody shirt at Lee's home on the Tuesday afternoon following the murder. Newt Lee was recalled to the stand and said that when he and Frank conversed together at the police station, that Frank told him, "If you keep that up, your story, Newt, we'll both go to hell." He told of Frank's apparent nervousness on Saturday afternoon. Asked about the bloody shirt, Lee said that if it was found at his house, it must have been his, that a white lady once made 4 shirts for him, that if it was a store-bought shirt, it didn't belong to him. Frank was recalled to the stand and testified in regard to the elevator, the time clock, his work Saturday afternoon, his actions that night and Sunday morning, and general questions in regard to arrangements at the factory. City detectives then called some character witnesses. Tom Blackstock, who said Frank was accustomed to pick at the factory girls and had placed his hands on them familiarly. Miss Nellie Wood of 8 Corpus Street, who said that she had worked about 2 years at the pencil factory, that Frank would come to her and put his hands on her when it was not called for, that he was too familiar and she didn't like it, that Frank had tried to pass it off as a joke and that she told him she was too old for that. And Mrs. C.D. Donegan of 165 West 14th Street, who said that she worked at the factory 3 weeks about 2 years ago, that Frank had winked and smiled at the girls, but never anything more than that. The character witnesses concluded the afternoon's testimony, and every spectator in the courtroom drew a long breath to think that at last the now famous Fagan case was to go to a body of men called together to pass upon it. It was then 6:10 in the afternoon of Thursday, May 7th, 11 days since Mary Fagan went to her death at the National Pencil Factory. Coroner Donahue began to deliver his charge to the jury. He said, "You have heard the statement of the county physicians. You have seen what caused death. You have seen the body and have heard the evidence in the case. It is your duty to inquire diligently as to how Mary Fagan came to her death. That was your oath. In case of unnatural death, you were to determine at whose hands death came. You have heard the county physician say strangulation caused death. In determining who is guilty of the murder, you turn to the evidence, and if you find that any other party is implicated or is attempting to shield the murderer, he is guilty in the same degree. Your position in this matter is similar to that of a commitment court, not a trial court. If there is a reasonable suspicion in your mind directed against any person or persons in connection with this crime, it is your duty to hold them. You also can hold witnesses who are essential in trying the case. If you think anybody not actually connected with the case has important information bearing upon it, you can hold them. If you believe anyone is concealing information, it is your duty to commit that person as an accessory of the crime. The six men forming the coroner's jury filed one by one out of the door. The crowd waited. Before 20 minutes had passed, back they came. The foreman stood up and announced the verdict. The coroner's jury had decided that Mary Fagan came to her death by strangulation, and recommended that Leo M. Frank, superintendent of the pencil factory, and Newt Lee, its night watchman, be held for investigation by the grand jury. When the verdict was announced, Frank and the Negro were at the tower, having been carried there as soon as the former concluded his testimony. At once, Deputy Sheriff Plenty Minor carried the news to the prisoners. Frank was in the hallway of the tower, reading an afternoon paper. The deputy approached him and told him that the coroner's jury had recommended that he and Lee be held for investigation by the grand jury. "Well, it's no more than I expected at this time," Frank told him. He made no further comment. Newt Lee was more visibly affected. When the news was broken to him, he hung his head in a dejected manner and appeared very much depressed. "I didn't do it, white folks," he muttered again and again.